Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the fastest growing segment of our society. And that is encouraging because it's for those of you like me who have come to know that there's something dreadfully wrong, especially destructive, about the religious and political institutions, even the media reporting and military invasions and jaundiced economic schemes that are tearing apart our society and our country. We realize that the institutions that are supposed to be the solution are, in fact, the problem. This is so encouraging now because for the first time probably ever in American history, two-thirds of Americans realize that we ought not go to war in Syria. And yet, every time in the past, we know when the president says, oh boy, you know, they crossed a red line, we've got to go and do our patriotic duty, Americans just acted as if the facts don't matter, we're going to rally around the flag and by over 90% support the military action. But not this time. And that tells you that there's something happening in America where there is a very significant percentage of Americans who now recognize that politics is part of the problem, not the solution. We can't rearrange the deck chairs on this Titanic of state and expect a different result. That it's become insane to expect another invasion, another attack, but this time to deliver entirely different results, since everything we have done in the past has failed so miserably. So this show is for the largest, fastest growing segment of our society. It's for the two-thirds of you who are, for the first time, maybe. Some maybe have been along this path for many, many years, recognizing that our political and religious institutions, our economic institutions, our military is not working for us, but is in opposition to us. So as a result, we're going to continue to devote this program to looking behind the headlines, to consider what really is happening, who is doing what to whom, who the manipulators are, what the consequence of these actions. We encourage you to participate in this discussion. You can call us toll-free anytime over the next 2 hours, 877-300-7645. We're not, however, going to leave our listeners without hope. We know where to turn for answers. There is hope. It's just that hope is not going to be found in a military. It's not going to be found in jaundiced economic schemes. It's not going to be found in religion. It's not going to be found in politics. But there is hope, and the second hour of this program is devoted to that hope. I think it's interesting, considering what happened in Washington yesterday, to look at the big picture. I want you to consider how quickly America's public institutions cower. The Senate shut down. They canceled the Washington Nationals baseball game for one shooter. I also think it's interesting to look at how quickly America's cities turn into police states. Look what happened in Boston by one runaway teenager who may not even have been armed. And the siege that was put upon that city by all manner of military and police and paramilitary establishments. Well, the same thing happened in Washington, D.C. The ATF was back on the job. The FBI, the CIA, city and district police, sheriffs, paramilitary of all ilk. All of their fancy SWAT team and communications armored personnel carriers. So many unmarked cars. Here we very, very rapidly turn into a police state. What happened to us? Now, this killing yesterday took place in the city with the most unconstitutional gun laws. Supposed to be the the place, in fact, it is the place where the Constitution is displayed, and yet it's the city that is most egregiously in conflict with the Second Amendment. This occurred in a building that's protected 24/7 with armed guards and double electronic passcode systems. It's in a building occupied by the military. What does that tell you? It tells you the opposite of what the president said yesterday. It tells you that more gun laws and more security and more control and less freedom is not the answer. Perhaps it's the problem. This young man who acted badly, his name is irrelevant. It's not part of any group. He's got psychiatric issues. Probably on psychiatric medication. What we look at is in the mass shootings in America over the last 20 years, the single most prevalent common denominator is the application, the use of drugs, the mind-numbing, mind-altering drugs. It is the use of them and the improper use of them, as well as the prescribed use of them and going on and off of them. But in every one of those cases, there's an issue of prescribed psychiatric medication. But let's look at this, man. He was retired Navy. Now, since military personnel are focused on and trained in fighting and killing, do you suppose that aggression just might be a common trait among those who choose an occupation predicated on fighting? Ever just put the correlation together? Think there is one? So why did we abandon the Jeffersonian principle? You know, he held that standing armies were the single greatest threats to a free nation. And yet, look what we have become. Let's just share a few of these thoughts on from Jefferson, and then I'm going to share some insights relative to the debate on guns. Jefferson wrote, "There are instruments so dangerous to the rights of the nation and which place them so totally at the mercy of their governors that those governors, whether legislative or executive, should be restrained from keeping such instruments on foot, but in a well-defined, but only in well-defined cases. Such an instrument is a standing army." Jefferson to David Humphreys, 1789. So the most dangerous instrument is a military establishment. Jefferson wrote, I do not like, in the new federal constitution, the omission of a Bill of Rights providing clearly and without the aid of sophisms for protection against standing armies. So what was Jefferson's single biggest complaint about the U.S. Constitution? He wrote this, by the way, to James Madison, who was the primary drafter of the U.S. Constitution. They were neighbors living in central Virginia. He wrote this in 1787. There was a provision in the U.S. Constitution, the Second Amendment, which spoke of the role that a militia plays in a nation's freedom, citizens. It spoke of the nation not being able to infringe on the right of citizen militias and citizens who wish to form militias to keep and bear arms. So its vision was the kind of weapons that would be used to fight battles. He's not envisioning deer rifles here. And yet, the nation prohibits the ownership of such weapons. Most states have even infringed that further. But what Jefferson was saying is that that's not enough. Just saying that the nation can't infringe on the rights of the citizens to keep and bear arms because militias are absolutely essential to the nation's freedom. And it was freedom from two different perspectives. He said that what the Constitution needed is a Bill of Rights protecting the people against what we have become, a military state, a standing army. It is the third largest expenditure of the country. Medicare, Medicaid is number one. Social Security is number two, which are wealth redistribution schemes, communism. And number three is the military. Now, what Jefferson realized is the thing that I've said so many times on this program. I didn't know that at the time that I was saying them that Jefferson wrote about these things, but it became obvious to me when you think about the Second Amendment that if the citizens' rights to keep and bear arms, all weapons, was not infringed, we wouldn't need a military. We could save not only the cost, $650 billion a year, of the military. We could save indoctrinating young men and women in fighting and killing. And the consequence of having indoctrinated and trained people in fighting and killing. We wouldn't be the world's largest exporter of weapons. We could use that revenue productively. We would not be prone to make bad situations worse and act suicidally by invading countries like Iran and Iraq, or even contemplate bombing Syria, if in fact we had followed this Jeffersonian principle. So I've long come to the conclusion that if we just honored the Second Amendment, it would be impossible for any nation to invade and occupy America. Impossible. No one would even try. We'll return to Jefferson quotes. I have three more of them to share with you when we return to Shattering Myths about why we ought not even have the kind of institution that was victimized by this shooter yesterday in Washington. And then I'm going to share with you two opposing views on gun control and whether or not gun ownership leads to gun violence. This is Shattering Myths. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering Jefferson's view on a standing military, of which America is, by the way, now is the largest in the world. We're not just the largest in the world, we're larger. Our military is more expensive than the rest of the world's combined. So let's return to Jefferson and what he had to say. In his first annual message, this is in 1801, Jefferson said, "Nor is it conceived needful or nor safe that a standing army should be kept up in a time of peace as a defense against invasion." So the very concept that Americans now, you know, as platitudes, "Oh, yeah, we honor our troops, let's wave the flag, we want to thank you for your service, you keep us free, if you provide all of our freedoms, and we're so grateful to you." Jefferson said, no, the opposite is true. So we have become the opposite of our founding fathers. That's generations, by the way, of propaganda and indoctrination. That's the consequence of patriotism. And it's pervasive in our society. In other words, that the man who is thought to be and probably is the most thoughtful, the most brilliant mind in the history of this country, Thomas Jefferson, his views on a standing military are the antithesis of the vast preponderance of Americans today. Now, is it because Jefferson wasn't as smart as the rest of us? Or is it because our educational systems have dumbed us down so that we no longer think rationally? What do you suppose it is? Jefferson wrote, "Standing armies are inconsistent with the people's freedom, and they are subversive to their quiet." Thomas Jefferson, a reply to Lord North's proposition in 1775. Quote, the spirit of this country is totally adverse to a large military force. Thomas Jefferson to Chandler Price, 1807. Quote, a distinction between the civil and military is one which it would be for the good of the whole to obliterate as soon as possible. Boy, this nation, we are the antithesis of that. This was Thomas Jefferson again. In his answers to John Baptiste de Maignet, in a discussion that also involved James Madison, this is what Jefferson wrote. This was his most complete and thoughtful position or presentation of his views on a standing military. He said, of all of the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded. Now, yesterday, when we were talking about Putin's speech, and we're going to return to Putin's speech probably tomorrow, when we were talking about Putin's speech, and he says, you know, what has happened to America? It used to be a country that exported its ideas, and now it's the first country to bring in a stick and bludgeon other countries and get involved militarily. And I went through and I showed that there have been 15 examples of this in the past 60 years, showing that every 4 years or every presidential term, the United States is involved using its military in a way that it ought not have done. Of all of the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded, because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes. And armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices and honors and emoluments is multiplied. And all the means of seducing the minds, patriotism here, folks, propaganda, are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect in republicanism may be traced in the inequity of fortunes and the opportunities for fraud growing out of a state of war, and in the degeneracy of manners and of morals engendered by both. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual war. And yet, ladies and gentlemen, for the past 60 years, that's what we have become. And if you go beyond that, it's most of the time since our nation's founding. Jefferson was right. What we have become is wrong. When we return to Shattering Myths after the commercial break, I'm going to share with you two additional thoughts, different perspectives on gun ownership. Good morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Larry on the line calling in from Florida. I'm going to share just two other insights before we make our way through the first of two articles on gun control. America claims to love peace, and yet our military is bigger than the rest of the world's combined. We think of ourselves as the nation putting an end to wars, and yet we are overwhelmingly the largest exporter of weapons in the world. The constitutionalist one, infecting the White House, will tell you that what happened in Washington is another example of gun violence that needs to be stopped by disarming Americans, of course, voiding the Second Amendment. But in reality, the more guns America owns, the less gun violence that occurs. Larry, I don't know if you know this, but you're a very well-read guy. There, in August of this year, Harvard published a study on gun ownership and homicides perpetrated by guns. It wasn't very well published. Would you like to guess as to why the Harvard study wasn't well published?
I'll take a stab at it. I'm going to guess that guns actually stopped a lot more crime than were perpetrated with guns.
That wasn't their focus, but it was pro gun ownership. Here's a little review of it. But again, Harvard study, and it never made it into a single national publication. Harvard study was entitled, Would Banning Firearms Reduce Murder and Suicide? It looks at figures for international deaths throughout continental Europe and juxtaposes them with the U.S. to show that more gun control does not lead to lower death rates or to violent or less violent crime. By juxtapose, it means that it's going to make a comparison as to what's happened in the United States and what's happened in Europe, correlating how many guns are owned by the population and how many deaths occur as a result of guns. Because the findings so clearly demonstrate that more gun laws may in fact increase death rates, the study says that, quote, the mantra that more guns mean more deaths and that fewer guns therefore mean fewer deaths is wrong. So the evidence did not play into the fabric of political correctness, so it didn't make headlines. And yet it came from Harvard. For example, when the study shows numbers for Eastern Europe, gun ownership, and corresponding murder rates, it is readily apparent that less guns do not mean less death. In Russia, where the rate of gun ownership is 4,000 per 100,000 inhabitants, the murder rate was 21%, or excuse me, 20.5, or 21, per 100,000 in 2002. That same year in Finland, where the rate of gun ownership is exceedingly higher, 39,000 per 100,000, so in other words, 39% in Finland, the murder rate was almost nil.
Switzerland.
at 2 per 100,000. So here's gun ownership at 39%. Death rate from homicide is 2 per 100,000. Gun ownership in Russia is 4%. And the murder rate from guns is 10 times greater. Now, looking at Western Europe, the study shows that Norway has far and away Western Europe's highest household gun ownership rate at 32%, but also its lowest murder rate. And when the study focuses on international deaths by looking at the U.S. versus continental Europe, the findings are no less revealing. The U.S., which is so often labeled the most violent nation in the world by gun control proponents, ranks seventh, actually, behind Russia, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Belarus, and the Ukraine in murders. America also ranks 22nd in suicides. The murder rate in Russia, where handguns are banned, is 30.6. The rate in the United States is 7.8. The authors of the study conclude that the burden of proof rests on those who claim that more guns equal more death and violent crime. Such proponents should, at the very least, be able to show a large number of nations with more guns have more deaths and that nations that impose the most stringent gun controls have achieved substantially reduced criminal violence and suicide rates. But after intense study, the authors conclude those correlations are not observed when a large number of nations are compared around the world. In fact, the numbers presented in the Harvard study support the contention that among the nations studied, those with more gun control tend toward higher death rates.
Yeah, that would bear out. Take South Africa, where they've taken their guns away. It's the highest in the world, 30.5.
Yes. All right. So
it's
that's
the highest,
the,
you know.
Yeah. That's yes.
Yeah.
Now that's the study from Harvard that no one seemed to care about. Never quoted by any politician. Just and it was, by the way, that study. Well, I'm not talking about something released long ago. That study was released at the end of last month. The datelines that you can find of blogs that that take you to the Harvard site that released the study are all dated the third week of August of this year. All right. So, but if you Google correlation between gun ownership and gun death, what you'll be taken to is another report that there was a teased press release that came out on it 4 days ago. It hasn't even been released yet. It hasn't even gone through peer review. But it dominates the news. Been published. Even preliminary indications of it have been published. Here is from a large Washington newspaper. It reads, the largest study of gun violence in the United States, released Thursday afternoon, confirms a point that should be obvious. Widespread American gun ownership is fueling America's gun violence epidemic. Every aspect of that is untrue. The study, by the way, has not yet been released. Just a press release teasing about it has been released. And it does not confirm the obvious because there's an indirect correlation between gun ownership and gun violence. As a matter of fact, gun violence in America is decreasing. So it's not an epidemic of gun violence in America. It is decreasing, and we are not amongst the most gun violent nations on earth. But you can be a journalist and lie today so long as you're advancing political correctness. The study by Professor Michael Siegel at Boston University and two co-authors has been peer-reviewed and is forthcoming in the American Journal of Public Health. So he just contradicted himself. He just said, it's forthcoming. It's in the peer review process. It's forthcoming. Has not been released yet. Siegel and his colleagues compiled the data on firearm homicides from all 50 states from 1981 to 2010, the longest stretch of time ever studied in this fashion. Well, the key thing there is that people have studied handguns and guns in America for much longer periods of time than 1981 to 2010. So that reference is irrelevant. What the journalist said to be misleading is in that fashion. They have a really odd way of going about coming up with their findings here, which I'll share with you in a moment. So in that fashion. So they're making it sound like this is the most comprehensive study ever done on the gun violence in America, when that's not true. It's like saying that I have a red wagon that I made with a blue handle. And I wrote a poem about the red wagon that I made with a blue handle, and it is the most comprehensive poem ever written about red wagons with blue handles that I have made.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. All right. Since we know,
logic for you.
Right, since we know, and when you read that in a journalistic piece, that means this is a lie. Since we know that violent crime rates overall, since we know that violent crime rates overall declined during that period of time. So, now, he began this by saying an epidemic of violence, and then he has to say, you know, it's true that we know that violent crime rates have overall declined during that period of time. And during that period of time, gun ownership has skyrocketed. All right, so if you just use the facts, gun ownership has skyrocketed. Violent crime rates have declined appreciably during that same period of time. The correlation is pretty obvious, but since they don't like that correlation, they came up with a different correlation, is what he said. So since we know that violent crime rates overall have declined during that period of time, the authors use something called, quote, a fixed effect regression, to account for any national trend other than the changes in gun ownership. So what they did is say, since it's so obvious that the increase in gun ownership is parallel to the reduction in violent crime, and since that's not what we want, what we're going to do is we're going to isolate everything except gun ownership. to tell you about the correlation between violent crime and gun ownership. In other words, I'm going to write the most comprehensive review of red wagons with blue handles, but what I'm going to do is exclude all information about red wagons with blue handles.
Wow.
Okay. They also employed the largest ever number of statistical controls for other variables, because what they did, they eliminated the one variable that is germane to, is there a correlation between an increase in gun ownership and a, what we now find is a decrease in violent crime. So what they did is they said, okay, since we're not going to look at gun ownership in that equation, what we're going to do instead is we're going to look at everything else we can imagine. So they have the largest number of variables: age, gender, race, ethnicity, urbanization, poverty, unemployment, income, education, income equality, divorce rate, alcohol use, violent crime rate, nonviolent crime rate, hate crime rate, number of hunting licenses, flux capacitors, and
throw that in there.
wait till you hear the actual basis of their findings. It is hilarious. I think you'll get a kick out of it. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Larry with us. We're talking about this new study that's going to be released here shortly in the American Journal of Public Health. That has decided that, well, it's being touted as the most comprehensive study on handgun violence in American history. It recognizes that as handgun ownership and gun ownership have escalated, that violent crime rates in America have declined. And so what it decided to do, since it didn't like that correlation, is to do a study that eliminated from the correlation between gun ownership and gun violence, gun ownership. Now, they said they did so because no good data on the national rates of gun ownership exist. You know, amongst the most licensed and controlled products in America are guns. And so if you were to say, you know, if you wanted to know about ownership of a particular product, there is no product that is, that we know more about, that has more licensing requirements and prohibitions against, than gun ownership. I mean, the number of televisions is vastly less known. The number of iPhones, unless you're the NSA and you're tracking all of them, is less known. So to say there's no new, good data, and they're, of course, here because they're liberals, saying because of the NRA's stranglehold on Congress, the authors used a percentage. Now, this is their strategy. The authors used a percentage of suicides that involved a firearm as a proxy. So they used the percentage of suicides that used a firearm. And you know what they came to the conclusion? Larry, this is amazing. That if you have a firearm, you are more likely to commit suicide with a firearm than if you don't have a firearm.
So you'd choose shooting yourself over, say, hanging yourself or jumping off of a bridge.
Well, they didn't do the correlation between, are you more likely to commit suicide by jumping off a bridge in an area that has many bridges versus an area that has no bridges? They didn't do that correlation. You know, it's the correlation between, if you own a rope, you are much more likely to commit suicide using a rope than if you don't own a rope. You know, if we want to study automobile accident rates and we wish to remove the driver from our consideration, then what we can find is there's 100% correlation between gasoline purchases and automobile accidents. Did you know that?
Yeah, there you go.
So their study, you know, here, what they found, like they found that you're 12% more likely to commit suicide with a handgun
if you own one.
If you own a handgun. Mm-hmm. Yep. And this is one standard deviation and change of firearm ownership shifted the gun murders by 12.9%. Yep. And their correlation was suicide by handgun. That's how stupid we have become.
Talk about a politically correct and politically driven article. It's nonsense. Anybody can see that on his face. I've seen studies that show that crime is stopped at the rate of something like 2 million a year in the United States because a person has a gun. And that means that there's a lot of rapes, murders, carjackings, whole number of things that are stopped because of gun ownership.
Yeah.
These people have an agenda. It's to take
right.
the guns from the people and lord over them.
It's the anti-Jeffersonian agenda. They want to have the standing army, standing police force, standing militia, everything imaginable, standing ATF, FBI, CIA. They want the U.S. government through so that it can pose its will on the people. They want them to be armed to the teeth, and they don't want people to be armed at all. And that way,
it's the daddy state thing, you know.
Yeah.
People don't realize it, but the police were never set up to protect you. They were set up to take people into court. You were to protect yourself. Originally, that's how things worked, you know.
But and so we're not that way anymore. Yeah, we're not that way anymore.
That's because we've been dumbed down to the daddy state. Everybody's supposed to protect us. Somebody will write a law that says we have to have a seat belt on, or safety belt, excuse me, or somebody will write a law that says we have to have a helmet on our bike, on our little heads while we ride our little bicycle down the road. And they do this all in the name of protecting us, but we all know it's really about lording over us, isn't it? It's about laws. It's about watching us.